calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Abraham Lincoln: I'm a firm believer in the people. If given the truth, they can be depended upon to meet any national crisis. And the great point is to bring them the real facts. Coming up on today's program, by the way, in the second hour, Gary Weiss is going to be here with his new book, Wall Street versus America, The Rampant Greed and Dishonesty That Imperils Your Investment. And, of course, we're going to get into this whole topic of what happened when the dictator of communist China, Mr. Hu, was heckled this morning on the lawn of the White House, and what the consequences and fallout of that may be and what it all means why George W. is kissing up to this guy. But right now, Mark Morano is with us. He's with Cybercast News Service, CNSnews.com, the website, a conservative news service. Mark Morano, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks a lot. I'm happy to be here.
Mark, I don't know if you're the author of it, but there's this recent piece about suggesting basically that, actually, I guess Susan Jones is the author. San Francisco's anti-Catholic resolution prompts lawsuit. Give us the setup on this thing.
Yeah, this is the San Francisco City Council, or separate Board of Supervisors, passed what conservative Catholic group, the Thomas More Law Center, is calling an anti-Catholic resolution. And what they essentially did, they passed a resolution urging local Catholic leaders in San Francisco area and Catholics to defy the Vatican directives telling Catholic adoption agencies not to place children with same-sex couples. And they essentially did this resolution, and they basically called the Vatican directive against homosexual adoption, quote, hateful, discriminatory rhetoric that is both insulting and callous, shows a level of insensitivity and ignorance. And what happened was, because this came out of the Board of Supervisors as an official government action, it was only urging. This was not making anything illegal, but it was still official, had the official seal of the government on it. The Thomas More lawsuit is claiming that this is a violation of the first 14th Amendment. They filed a lawsuit against this, and of course the Catholic League for Religious Civil Rights, another group, has weighed in on this as well, and they're essentially accusing the San Francisco Board of Supervisors of anti-Catholic bigotry, and at the same time the San Francisco Board of Supervisors accusing the Catholic Church of anti-homosexual bigotry. So it's quite a quandary what's going on right now in San Francisco.
Isn't it legal for gays to adopt in California?
I believe it is legal, yes.
So then the Board of Supervisors is telling a corporation, basically, a nonprofit corporation, albeit, but nonetheless, the Catholic adoption agencies are corporations. They're telling a corporation that, in their opinion, they're not even mandating, that they're in their opinion, that corporation should comply with the law, and the corporation is saying that you're bigots?
The corporation is saying there's a separation of church and state. And this has a chilling effect. And the fear here is because, granted it is San Francisco, and you would expect that if any resolution were to pass in America, it would probably be San Francisco, because the Catholic teachings are diametrically opposed to, I guess, what you'd say, a large percentage of the population, homosexuals living in San Francisco. So there's always been sort of a tension there. But what the Thomas More Law Center is saying, what the Catholic League is saying, what many other Catholics are saying, is this is a chilling effect. It's essentially violating a separation of church and state, because now it's like a hostile work environment. It's essentially Catholics in the city, Catholic institutions in the city, now feel as though they've been condemned by the local government for tenets of their faith, regardless of the law. We're talking about, this is according to Catholic theology, according to the Vatican and the current Pope, the teachings on homosexuality. And
I understand. So, Mark Morano, I'm curious. Yes. Do you think that the laws in Utah, which make it illegal for the legally incorporated Mormon sects which practice polygamy, are an unlawful violation of the separation of church and state?
Yeah, obviously there's limits to anything when you look at that. I haven't studied the polygamy issue, but I will say that that is against the law, and that is something that used to be legal, but the government made it illegal. However, this is a private institution. This is an adoption agency that is run privately. It's not seeking the stamp of approval of the state in the sense that, like for instance, polygamy would be. You'd have to go to the state. You either need a minister ordained.
Well, adoption actually requires the approval of the state as well, Mark.
Just
as much as marriage does.
It's not a state adoption. I mean, it's a separate entity. It's a private.
No, but adoption still has to be validated and certified by the state in the exact same way that marriage is. There are certain legal rights that come with adoption and certain legal obligations that are not that dissimilar from marriage.
But are you alleging that, I mean, do you want to see now, you know, all faith, because you use the extreme example of polygamy, for instance, do you want to see all faith now, particularly Catholic teaching on this? Do you want to see this? Don't you think there'd be a line of violating separation of church and state? I mean, I understand.
My suggestion is that the Catholic teaching is the extreme teaching. If you look at the research that's been done on gay and lesbian adoptive parents, that you find that, number one, the kids aren't more or less likely to grow up gay. Number two, they do grow up with, you know, all the benefits of loving parents. I used to work in this field. I mean, from 1978 to 1983, Say what?
Oh, I said sure. Yeah, okay.
I mean, I was the executive director of a residential treatment facility for severely disturbed and emotionally disturbed kids and abused children in New Hampshire, the New England Salem Children's Trust. And I'm still on the board of directors of it here 27 years later. And I can tell you, there's 700,000 children in the system in the United States right now who really could benefit from having parents. Because being in an institution, even in a good institution like the one I used to run, is not a good thing for kids. And in my opinion, what you and what the Catholics in California would do is deprive these children of families that are actually willing to take them in, simply because those families happen to be made up of a gay couple.
Well, first of all,
this is wrong in my opinion.
Catholic teaching has nothing to do with whether a child would grow up well, whether this or that, whether, you know, they would be happy or whether they'd be more likely to grow up gay in a gay-headed household or, you know, two parents of the same sex. They're basically saying that they consider homosexuality a sin, and the same Catholic agencies, I would assume, would not adopt a kid with non-married, you know, opposite-sex partners because it would be against Catholic teaching. So I don't think it's as simple as that. And I think it's when you get into again, this is just a resolution urging it, but it's a chilling effect. And what you're saying is even further. You're saying essentially that the Catholic Church is teaching that homosexuality should be outlawed, much the same way
what I'm saying is that right wingers are demagoguing this issue, and they're demagoguing Catholic issues selectively. The Catholic Church, the Pope. Pope John Paul II, Pope John Paul II officially condemned the invasion of Iraq. He officially condemned it. And I don't hear you guys running around going, hey, Catholic teaching says that we shouldn't be in Iraq.
Well,
our Catholic soldiers shouldn't have to go to Iraq because it's against their religion.
Come on, Tom, you're selective. If you get a catechism of the Catholic Church, you will find not one sentence in there about the condemnation of the war in Iraq, but you will find condemnation of homosexual behavior. It's not the same argument. And the Pope saying something does not mean it's Catholic catechism or Catholic theology that goes back thousands of years. That's the current Pope's opinion, and does not mean all Catholics must follow it. Just like the death penalty, which has been demagogued by many on the left, saying, oh, well, the Pope, Catholic Church against it. They're against it they're against it in principle, but they're not against it in complete terms. And it's a different issue. So I don't think that's the issue. I think the effect here is, why is government getting involved? And you basically laid it out.
Because government supervises adoptions.
No, but you want this treated like Utah polygamy. If you want to outlaw Catholic teachings in this country that you don't agree with, and that, my friend, is a violation of separation of church and state. Or let me rephrase it. I don't want to put myself in the middle of this issue in terms of that. I'm trying to give you analyzing talking points on this, but the Thomas More Law Center and the Catholic League is saying that your philosophy in the San Francisco Board of Supervisors is the first step to the violation of separation.
Now, what I'm suggesting, Mark Morano, is that if a religion wants to say we should be able to do something that is inconsistent with the laws of a state, particularly something that has to do with something as intimate as marriage or as adoption, we want to do something that's inconsistent with these laws simply because it's our belief, whether it's Mormons being polygamists or whether it's, you know, gays adopting kids, which is a really terrible, frankly, juxtaposition. But nonetheless, these are the extremes. I say in either case that the religion should have no business in deciding what the, you know, how the state is conducting the certification of adoption. And if a church wants to get into the adoption business, then they should conform with the laws of the state. Just like if they want to get into the marriage business, they have to conform to the laws of the state.
Well, I think what you're saying is what's probably going to happen eventually is if these kind of resolutions pass by the Board of Supervisors and then turns into the state of California, I think the Catholic Church will either get out of the adoption business or go to friendlier territory for their beliefs. And what's going to happen is you're going to have less adoption going on in that state. But, of course, activists, people like yourself are going to be happy because the tainted
I think it would be a tragedy if the Catholics decide to take that bigoted a position and absolutely deprive children of the resources to get out of institutions and become part of a happy family.
Well, we'll see how this plays out, but I think, your comparison is basically saying they have to conform to whatever law of the moment is passed in a state is going to cause problems. This is 2,000 years of Catholic teaching, and this is a clear...
Actually, it's not. It's a few hundred years of Catholic teaching. It's in any case, Mark Morano, CNS News. Thanks for being with us, Mark.
Thank you.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Like the sermon on the mountain, says the Dharma got the gun. Hellfire and brimstone, swap for oil and guns.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's skin of the teeth day. Tim in New York running around. You're doing good, Tim. And Dan and Alex, thank you. Welcome back to the program. No, I just to wrap this thing up, I don't think it's anti-Catholic for the city of San Francisco to say if you're going to put kids up for adoption, it's legal for gay couples to adopt them, and therefore you should shouldn't discriminate against gay couples. That's called anti-discrimination policy. I mean, the Catholic Church once sanctioned slavery. Would it have been considered anti-Catholic to go along with that? The Catholic Church once sanctioned abortion. They once murdered witches. I mean, at some point, you stand up and you say, no. The bigotry du jour, and it's not limited to the Catholic Church. You find this across American society and particularly across fundamentalist religious society in the United States. And it's not limited just to even Christianity. But there is this endemic, long-standing, deeply rooted bigotry against gays, and I think it's tragic, and particularly tragic when there's 700,000 more or less kids in the system who are on a daily basis being harmed by the fact that they are growing up, they're going through the developmental phase of their life without parents, without people who really love them and are willing to care for them and can do right by them, gay or straight. And instead are living in institutions or are living in foster homes where they're cycled through and a lot of foster parents are just doing a great and noble work. And I can tell you, I've been out there, I've seen it. There are foster parents who are basically running foster homes the way that some dog breeders are running puppy kennels. You know, it's basically how many can we move through here? How much money can we make on it? And that's a tragedy too. But even in the very best of foster homes, and as I said, there are many wonderful foster homes out there. Even in the best of foster homes, the kids are still in limbo. They're still outside the system, or they're still caught up in the system outside of a family. And if a family's available, a family wants to take them in, that family should be eligible to, regardless of their sexual orientation. Paula in Bayonne, New Jersey. Our phone number, 800-440-8466. Hey, Paula, what's up?
Hey, Tom. This issue gets me so angry. As a former Catholic, I really, really get annoyed with the inconsistencies.
Let's take, first of all,
your guest, when he was saying that this is merely a matter of church doctrine. Am I wrong, but don't adoptions have to go through the court system?
Yeah, that was my point. This is actually a legal process.
And the court systems are funded by taxpayers, and as a taxpayer, I'm not interested in supporting bigotry.
Yes. Well, there was a time, when the Catholic Church in the United States conformed with what were the laws at the time. I don't know if it was Catholic policy or not, but the adoption agencies would not adopt children into different racial groups, parents, I think we've all kind of shaken our heads and looked back and said, boy, those were the bad old days.
And as far as just the disingenuous, you know, how ingenuous he was when he tried to, like, separate this topic from the death penalty or from the war.
Yeah.
Or from abortion. Now, Arnold Schwarzenegger had a chance, what, within the last 6 months to spare two men their lives?
Mm-hmm.
Were on death row, and he chose not to. There was nothing said by the Catholic Church about that, by the American Catholic Church.
No, because he's a conservative Republican.
And during the election, I was angry when how many times was John Kerry was denied communion because of his opinion on abortion?
Well, and do you know why that was? That was because the guy who is the current pope was then the head of the department in the church, the Office of Doctrine, I believe it's called, which is the current incarnation of the old Office of the Inquisition. And, you know, and his job is to keep the church doctrine pure. And he sent letters out to to bishops in the United States saying that John Kerry, essentially implicitly, that any Catholic politician who believes or who argues that politically abortion should be legalized or should remain legal in the United States should be denied communion. I mean, this is the current pope back in the 2004 election, interfering in U.S. politics.
Exactly, and there's one point I want to bring up about him that doesn't come up a lot, but I think in this context it is an appropriate, it's appropriate to bring it up. This is a man who came of age in Nazi Germany.
Yeah, well,
and I'm
willing to cut him some slack for that.
What kind of influence did that have on him?
Yeah.
Or perhaps it's more than just church doctrine.
See, he's not the only guy saying this, Paula. I mean, you know, Mark Morano didn't come of age in Nazi Germany. He's saying the same thing.
I think it's for people like Mark Morano, which is just politically expedient for conservatives to bash gays.
Yeah,
Frankly, I don't think they care, but I think that's how
disagree.
They get the religious right out.
Yeah. Well, and it seems to work for some of these politicians. Paula, I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Rick in Grand Rapids. Rick, we just have a few seconds left. Quick thought.
Well, I don't know if I can get it all in.
Okay, give it a shot.
Well, I don't know if you're familiar with this.
Yeah, hang on. We'll give it a shot when we come back. We're having strange times here with the automation.
Okay,
hang on.
I'll hold.
Thanks. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. We're going to get back into the issue of what's going on in China, too, and come back at the bottom of the hour here. We'll be back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And it's gone, gone, going, gone, everything gone, give a damn. Gone be the birds when they don't want to sing, gone people.
And welcome back, my friends. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. It's the Tom Hartman Program. That's me, 34 minutes past the hour. Glad to have you with us and glad to be here. We've got some really interesting immigration stuff in the news we're going to get to in a few minutes. What's going on in China? Or is it who's going on? No, who? No, what? No, yeah, who's on first? Yeah. who was heckled on the White House lawn today? Yes. We'll get to that in just a minute. Rick in Grand Rapids, you are making a point, Rick.
Well, yeah, you've been talking about religion there in the last few minutes, and certainly religion should be a good thing, but of course the fundamentalist type, whether it occurs in Catholic religion, Protestant, or Islamic, can be quite dangerous, as we can see with world events. But a couple of nights ago, I was watching, well, I won't mention the name of the hosts, the liberal and the conservative on Fox.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and they had this woman on. I guess she's the daughter of this Fred Phelps guy, the guy who's apparently organizing protests.
The God hates fags guy.
Yeah, that, I wasn't going to say the word.
They're doing the protests at the funerals of soldiers who've died in Iraq.
These are dead gay soldiers, apparently.
Well, actually, they're doing all soldiers.
Oh, they're doing it all. Now.
These guys are just so desperate for publicity. They're saying that the reason why the soldiers died is because God is punishing America because we sanction homosexuality.
Okay, I don't think
that's
we do.
That's their shtick.
But anyway, this woman was so hateful that even the conservative guy was having a real problem with her. And I got to tell you, I've seen Ann Coulter on many times, but this woman has got her beat, and it's apparent that her father has just, you know, this is not a young woman. I mean, she's a young woman, but she's no kid. And it's just apparent that her father has just brainwashed her
Yeah, Fred Phelps is running a little cult there at the Westboro Baptist
right,
Church.
But his own daughter has become such a hateful individual.
And most of the members of his cult are actually members of his family. I'm just amazed that anybody takes them seriously.
Well, of course, I guess when you put them on nationwide television, you're right. I guess you do give them too much publicity. But
this is why I don't have them on the show. I mean, they don't represent Christianity any more than... I can't even come up with an example. I mean,
well,
any more than, you know, chocolate fudge represents Christianity. I mean, there's such a disconnect there. It's not even they're what they represent. Yeah, I mean, they're closer to the KKK than they are to Christianity. And the KKK, by the way, represents itself as a Christian organization. That's probably a better metaphor.
But it probably would be a good disinfectant to let people know that this kind of malicious.
This is the logical end point of that kind of bigotry. Good point, Rick. Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Bob in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tom. I agree. I think it's a government or a state issue, too. And, you know, since when is adopting, you know, a kid, you know, a bad thing?
Right.
And, you know, why would Holy Mother Church decide to go get involved in this? They have other issues that they probably should be addressing. But then again, you know, even if, you know, there's been some known people who have went out and disagreed with the church and a lot of their views. And I'll give you a for instance, like Hans Kung, who is pretty progressive. And look what ended up happening to him. And he's one of the smartest minds in all of Catholicism. And they defrocked him. And I mean, he's an outcast.
I'm not Catholic. I'm not familiar with Hans. What's the very in a sentence or two? What's the story there, Bob?
He had such opposing views as to what was going on in the Catholic Church, and he was matter of fact, he gave the new Pope his first job.
Hmm.
And he was defrocked because of a lot of his views.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is something to be said for a religion or a cult or a sect maintaining consistency in their theology and perspective. And while I would be the first to suggest that when a religion or a cult or a sect becomes any kind of institutionalized, you know, expression of religion becomes involved in matters of governance, in matters of the state, that they have become toxic. On the other hand, I think that internally they have every right to. You know, Reverend Moon, if he and his followers want to do whatever they want to do, he wants to marry, you know, 1,000 people at once who've never met each other, that's between Reverend Moon and his followers, in my opinion. I don't have a problem with it. I'd cringe a little if one of my kids was involved with it. I'd cringe a lot, actually. But when Reverend Moon decides that he wants to change U.S. foreign policy by buying the Washington Times and making it the only newspaper that conservatives read in Washington, D.C., then I have a big problem with it. But, you know, otherwise it's like keep the cults within the cults. Brian in Manchester, New Hampshire. Hey, Brian.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Hi. First about the Catholic, I don't see how any gay adopting a child is oppressing Catholics at all in this country or any other. But getting back to this,
and there have to be gay Catholic couples,
right? Okay. Well, that's okay. It's a Catholic adoption agency.
Yeah, it's a Catholic adoption agency, and you know, I know gay Catholics. There have to be gay Catholic couples out there who want to adopt.
Just before I went in the service out in West Hollywood, California, there's a huge gay Catholic church in West Hollywood there that has a huge congregation. Anyways, talking about Pope Benedict, I wonder myself how he even was allowed to take over from this great Polish lad that he took over the papal title from.
John Paul II was, I think, far more conservative than most people realize.
Yeah.
And Benedict was following his line.
But you have to remember, Tom, that Benedict was involved in many of the moving these priests around, these monsters that were alleged child molesters when they should have been taken to the police station for trial. And he was involved in that, and he's trying to tell John Kerry about morals.
Well, yeah, I don't know that that's the case. May well be. I just don't know.
It's in the history. But also, and one other thing, I'm reading your book, Ultimate Sacrifice, about the talk about the first Catholic president, the first non-WASP president, really, John F. Kennedy.
Right.
He was easy. I think he was, our king was assassinated right before our eyes. But talking about the mafia connection, Johnny Roselli, he was friends with Sinatra. And Sinatra was close friends with JFK, right?
Yeah, sort of. Sinatra and JFK, I wouldn't call them close friends, but they certainly knew each other socially, yeah.
Okay, but to me, Sinatra was so connected to the mob and so close to Johnny Roselli. How could he not have known to then warn Jack Kennedy about what Roselli had intended for him and the other?
I don't think Sinatra knew.
No.
These guys, they knew how to keep things close to the vest. But I don't want to get into the whole Kennedy assassination.
So I'm not
By the way, with the History Channel in May is going to be doing a special based on our book, in part. I'll let you all know when the date comes for that. Brian, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Elaine in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hey, Elaine. Elaine?
Yes.
Welcome to the program. You are live on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that we adopted a foster child from the state about a year ago, and we're considering adopting a drug baby. And Catholic Services here handles those babies. My partner and I are single, but we're male-female. And I called, and they would have allowed that.
So they would, which is contrary to church teachings. You're living in sin.
Exactly. Now, why would they allow that? I'm sure what would happen is that it would just never come up, that it would be assumed that we were married. The gay thing, I'm sure, because of the fact that it's same sex, they can't cover that.
Right. They can't. But, they can't. Wink, wink. Nod, nod.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I thought that was quite interesting to hear the program this morning about homosexuals not being allowed to adopt. There is such a need.
Yeah, but what this is, you're absolutely right, Elaine. What this is the right wing is getting ready for the 2006 elections. And what they are trying to do is put these wedge issues front and center in front of the American people and they're going to start beating the drum and, the gays are coming, you know.
Right.
One year it's the flag burners are coming.
Another year it's
Willie Horton is coming. You know, this year it's going to be the gays are coming. And I just don't think it's going to fly. I think these guys are shooting themselves in the foot. Elaine, thanks for the call and thanks
You're
for
welcome.
Up on that. Interesting. Bye. Jan in Fairfax, Virginia. Hey, Jan, welcome to the program.
How are you?
I am great. What's up?
Good. I used to run a social service agency in Boston, St. Francis House, which is the largest homeless program in Boston. It was funded by the Franciscans. And it's a bad mix, having religion overlaying, imposing their philosophy in any service delivery arena, including adoption or homelessness, because there's strings attached and it interferes with the effective intervention. I mean, we couldn't give condoms to homeless retarded women. I mean, it's just not a good mix.
Yeah, that's tragic. I mean, now we're back to the big debate that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison had. Jefferson believed that both of them were opposed to the intermixing of church and state. And Jefferson's fear was that somebody who was involved in the church would someday get into politics and start, messing with politics. In other words, the church would try to take over the government, because that had happened in the state of Massachusetts in his lifetime. He'd seen it happen. And Madison didn't believe that was possible. Madison was much younger than Jefferson, although actually it was going on. I mean, Massachusetts almost seceded in 1800. Madison, though, wasn't so concerned about the church taking over the state. He was concerned that if the state gave money to the churches, they would corrupt the churches. And that's why the first presidential veto of James Madison, the fourth president's presidency, was vetoing a bill that gave money to a Protestant church in Washington, D.C., to care for the homeless. And he said, we can't do this. If we want to care for these people, and we will allocate money for it, but it can't go through a church. It has to be a secular thing.
Because it isn't altruism. It's not when the state delivers the service. There's some degree of altruism, at least there's supposed to be. When the Catholic Church delivers it, it's imposed. It's infused with philosophy. You have to buy into their...
Yeah, it's not just altruism at that point, then it also becomes evangelism. Jan, thank you for the call, and a very good point you make. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I hear the voices.
I'm a war president.
Bring them on. I hear the voices.
Uh-oh.
Subvert the legislature.
I hear the voices.
We will not turn back.
Yeah, he hears the voices. Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we run rings around the right wing. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Right here, wherever you may be listening to us. Very glad to have you with us. Phil in Baton Rouge, Louisiana on the line. Hey, Phil, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I just wonder how much does it cost to fill up a container ship that ships cheap goods from China back to the United States. You've got raw materials that go to Chinese, basically Chinese/American factories, because a lot of U.S. Entrepreneurs have invested in factories in China.
Right.
So then,
although when they do, they have to have a Chinese partner, because the Chinese won't let Americans do what the Chinese can do, which is go in and simply buy a company and own it.
Right, but they'll take advantage of the cheap labor in China.
That's right. They'll let us go in and have a partnership with a local Chinese entrepreneur and start a business. But you can't have 100% American ownership of Chinese companies.
Well, I know of a business here in the city I live in, the Baton Rouge company that sells rattan furniture that they fly to China to take a working vacation. They order the furniture according to the way they want it made. It gets custom made. They buy container loads of this stuff, ship it back to Baton Rouge, and then sell it. You know, they have a shop here in Baton Rouge that sells that furniture. Well, what is the price of fuel going to do to that?
Well, it's going to raise it slightly, but the transportation cost on the stuff coming from China is not really all that substantial. Shipping, transatlantic, transpacific shipping is really startlingly efficient in terms of the amount of fuel that goes into one little, goodie, a plasma TV or a computer or a knick-knack or whatever, a piece of rattan furniture.
So the only negotiable price is the labor price.
That's the major price, yeah. That's the major variable is the cost of labor. Yep.
Oh, also, before I let you go, thanks again for The Ultimate Sacrifice. I read it. It's a great book. I appreciate you for the book. I'll just put in shameless plug for it. Everybody ought to read it.
Okay, thanks a lot, Phil. I appreciate
it. Tom.
Good to hear from you. Thank you. Yeah, and in fact, I believe it's going to be May 10th that the History Channel or the Discovery Channel. Oh, I'm going to have to look it up now. It's one or the other. It's going to be doing something on this, and I'll let you know all the details on that. In fact, let's see here. It looks like it's going to be on the Discovery Channel. Indeed, the Discovery Channel. It's called Conspiracy Files, JFK Assassination. Also includes John Newman, me, Lamar Waldron. Actually, I'm not sure if I'll be in there. It may just be Lamar. We'll see. We both went to New York and were filmed on this thing. And it looks like it's going to be on May 10th. So, well, you know, we'll see how it all shakes out. But just as an FYI, May 11th, on May 11th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and again on May 12th at 1 a.m. This is, and we were just talking about the cost of labor. Considered felons, this is an Associated Press story, considered felons by their government, these migrants fear detention, rape, and robbery. Police and soldiers hunt them down at railroads, bus stations, and flea bag motels. Sometimes they're deported. More often, officers simply take their money. What country am I talking about? The level of brutality that these migrants face was apparent Monday when police conducting a raid for undocumented migrants near a rail yard shot to death a local man, apparently because his dark skin and work clothes made officers think he was a migrant. Virginia Sanchez, who lives near the railroad tracks that carry Central Americans north to the U.S. border, said such shootings in Tultitlan, Mexico, are common. We're talking about Mexico here. This is how Mexico treats illegal immigrants. At night, she says, you hear the gunshots, and it's the judiciales, the state police, chasing the migrants. Carlos Lopez, a 28-year-old farmhand from Guatemala, said if you're carrying any money, they take it from you. The federal, state, local police, all of them. He's crouching in a field near the tracks in whatever the name of the city is, waiting to climb on a northbound freight train. Lopez said he had been shaken down repeatedly in 15 days of traveling through Mexico. He said the soldiers are there as soon as we cross the river. He said, they say you can't cross unless you leave something for us. Jose Ramos, 18, of El Salvador, says the extortion occurs at every stop in Mexico until migrants are left penniless and begging for food. He said if you're on a bus, they pull you off and search your pockets, and if you have any money, they keep it and say, get out of here. Maria Elena Gonzalez, who lives near the track, said female migrants often complain about abusive police. She said they force you to strip, supposedly to search you, but the purpose is to rape you. And this goes, Interior Secretary Carlos Abascal said Monday that Mexico is a country with a clear, this is the Mexican Interior Secretary, with a clear, defined, and generous policy toward migrants. Although the nation of 105 million, Mexico, has only legalized, in the past 5 years, they have only legalized 15,000 immigrants from all countries in the world. Mexico, over the last 5 years, has only allowed legally into their country 15,000 people. And illegal immigrants, they hunt them down and shoot them. And while Mexicans denounce the criminalization of their citizens living without papers in the United States, this is from the Associated Press, Mexican law classifies undocumented immigration as a felony punishable by up to 2 years in prison. Isn't that fascinating? If you illegally immigrate into Mexico, they will hunt you down, they will shoot you, or they will put you in prison for 2 years because you are a felon. The country of Mexico, in 5 years, a five-year period, has only legalized 15,000 immigrants. We legalize about 1 million immigrants a year in the United States. And they're saying that we have a wrong immigration policy? This is mind-boggling. Considered felons by the government, these migrants fear detention, rape, and robbery. And they're talking about people from Central America immigrating into Mexico from the south. Mind-boggling. Meanwhile, in the United States, the Immigration Service, the INS, starting to arrest both workers and bosses. We'll see how this plays out. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Are they out to get us? They being Wall Street. Are they? Maybe. Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Gary Weiss is with us. He's the author of Wall Street versus America, the rampant greed and dishonesty that imperils your investment. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi there, Tom.
Great to have you with us. Tell us who Rand Groves is and why we should care.
Rand Groves, I view him as every man. He's your typical small investor. And what happened with Rand Groves happens to thousands of investors is that he got into a dispute with his broker. And when he got into a dispute with his broker, he found to his amazement that he did not have the constitutional rights to a trial by a court and a jury if he chose, because he signed away his rights. Wall Street took away his rights.
Now, you say he went from a paper millionaire to a thousandaire to a hundredaire to a nothingaire?
That's right. He lost all his money.
How so? What happened?
The broker, according to Mr. Groves, and of course I should point out that the broker, Merrill Lynch broker, denies it. Mr. Groves claims that he gave that he failed to really live up to his obligation to give the man proper advice on how to manage this windfall that he got. He got a stock options windfall, as lots of people got back around the dot-com era.
Mm-hmm.
But the real problem was he got caught up in this Kafka-esque Wall Street arbitration system, which strips investors of their constitutional rights. And regulators, and this is a theme that runs throughout the book, regulators are complicit, and to a great extent, the media is also complicit.
Well, this requirement for arbitration is not unique to signing agreements with a broker. I mean, a lot of folks sign employment contracts that say you're signing away your rights to litigation and you have to go to arbitration. That's increasingly common across the United States, those people who are lucky enough to even have an employment contract. And there are a lot of other contracts. Don't banks and credit card companies have these kind of provisions? A lot of mortgages have these kind of provisions?
Oh, absolutely. And actually, for the most part, arbitration is usually a fair way of settling disputes.
So why say that Wall Street is using arbitration to basically screw small investors when it's fairly common?
Because the Wall Street arbitration system is unique. It's not the kind of arbitration that you run into if you have an employment contract. They run the system, and it's required. And usually in arbitration, you've got three arbitrators or possibly even one arbitrator, and they're fair and they're impartial. It's sort of like an accelerated form of the ordinary court system. In this instance, you get usually all of the arbitrators. One of the arbitrators is currently employed by the securities industry, and all of the arbitrators ordinarily have, even the so-called public arbitrators, have some kind of ties to the securities industry. So it's what you call a stacked deck. Now, they used to allow independent arbitrators, but Wall Street made it so that alternative was kicked out. That's been about 20 years.
We're talking with Gary Weiss. He's a former reporter for Business Week and the author of Born to Steal and his newest book, Wall Street versus America, The Rampant Greed and Dishonesty That Imperils Your Investments. Tell us about Genesis Intermedia here, Gary.
Well, there is a stock that was pushed by a newsletter called the Waco Kid. Turned out to be, and this is a stock, and I should say that back in the 80s, 90s, you had this operation called it's a stock that basically was pushed as the most valuable stock, the most undervalued stock in America. It's now 1/100 of a cent. And it's very,
which I assume is below what it was when they said it was undervalued.
It sure was.
So is this a case of somebody running an investment newsletter and getting into bed with a company that's doing an IPO simply for the purposes of getting investors and then walking away with the cash and then splitting the thing up?
Well, it's actually a lot more subtle than that. This is an example of a phenomenon that you see where you got these Wall Street newsletters that are pushing stock that just aren't worth anything. And they don't even necessarily have to have any kind of special arrangement with the company. It's part of this whole microcap fraud scandal, which is continuing to this day.
So do they like buy a bunch of the stock and then go out and push it, and then when the price of it goes up, they sell?
Well, that's they say.
Or do they just push it for the hell of it?
It's a lot worse than that, in effect, because it's got people. They're telling people to buy these stock, and by telling people to buy the stock, it pushes up the price of the stock. It's like a pyramid scheme.
Sure.
And it gets people sucked into these stocks, and then they eventually collapse. That's what always happens.
Yeah.
And you get sucked in.
You describe Smith Barney, the brokerage firm, as a fun-loving bunch of fellows fond of wine, women, and more women, according to various lawsuits over the years. You describe Morgan Stanley, which admitted no wrongdoing but agreed in 2003 to pay a $50 million settlement, as which is about what it spends on metal polish for the executive silverware. These guys don't come off well in your book, Wall Street versus America, Gary Weiss. Is this... You know, organized crime, or is this simply, or some variation thereof, or is this simply, you know, the normal American corporation basically operating on the rules of capitalism and making as much as they possibly can?
This is business as usual on Wall Street. This is what the media doesn't write about. You don't hear them refer to Bear Stearns, as I call him, the Eddie Haskell of Wall Street, if you know your 1960s TV comedies, always pushing the envelope and always ripping people off because they've got this PR machine that intimidates the media. And I describe that in the book.
Yeah.
You don't get the truth.
what is a person to do if they've got some money in savings and they see, I mean, the headline's bull market. You know, the market just hit a new high.
Yeah.
Although at the same time, gold is hitting new highs, oil is hitting new highs, all these commodities are hitting new highs. Wall Street Journal says it's because, particularly with oil, not because of supply and demand, but because investor money is flowing into oil. So if it's flowing into oil, why is it not coming out of the stock market? How come the stock market isn't falling? What's going on here? What's an investor to think?
Well, you know, I think that you got to be a little bit careful with the markets. You know, nobody really knows, really. I mean, this is true. Nobody really knows why the market does what it does.
So when they come on TV at night and they say the market was a little skittery today because George said so and so, they just pull that stuff out of their left ear.
Literally. Yeah. But there's things you can do. You can take advantage of the market. If you think the market's going up, there's things you can do and not get ripped off. And I get into that in the book. It's pretty simple. Wall Street doesn't want you to buy them because they don't make money on them. But there's things you can do.
For example?
Index funds. I go into that a lot. These are low-cost mutual funds.
You're basically saying don't bother paying somebody for their advice.
Exactly.
If
they're wrong.
Yeah.
They're always wrong.
Investment advisors are always wrong.
They're always wrong.
So what's your advice right now, Gary Weiss? Do you think that the market's going to go up or down? Do you think the commodities are going to go up or down? Should people be buying gold? Say somebody's sitting on some money, you know, retirement funds. They got a 401k or whatever. How should they invest?
I'm glad you asked me that question because anybody that tells you they know where the market's heading, they're lying. They don't know. There's no way of predicting the markets, and that's why I say put your money in index funds. That way the market will hit you over the long term, okay? Over the long term, you'll do okay, but you can't predict the market over the next year or so. You can count on the market over the long term doing okay. If you've got some good long-term goals, you can put money in this in index funds. But don't listen to people who say, put your money in gold. Don't listen to them because they don't know what they're talking about.
What about people who do, like, charting of commodities, for example? You know, the A rise, the B decline, the C rise, the D decline. They've got all these charts and graphs, and it really looks like they know what they're talking about.
It's a lot of baloney. Commodities are a zero-sum game. You got to stay away from commodities.
But anybody who put their money into gold 10 years ago is doing very well right now.
Yeah, but they couldn't predict it, because if they could predict it, I'd have put all my money in gold, too. You can't predict the movement of commodities. You only know what happened in the past, and that doesn't help you.
Yeah, although isn't there something to be said for the rise in the price of oil and gold, for example, specifically, being tied right now to Bush and his saber rattling?
If you're worried about, well, it is. Now, let me tell you something, too. If you're concerned about such things, there are low-cost investment vehicles you can put your money in to take advantage of oil prices. There's indexes related to the oils.
Exchange-traded funds.
Index-traded funds, ETFs, you know. So, sure, if you can definitely hedge against inflation, put a portion of your money in indexes. But stay away from commodities. You get ripped off in commodities. And they're a zero-sum game. I watch those things.
Right. But in other words, don't buy the gold coins. Don't buy a barrel of oil. But you can buy stock in a company like Exxon that's in the, God forbid, that's in the oil business, or a mining company that's in the gold mining business.
That's, you know, you got to hold your nose when you buy an Exxon. But I got to say that if you want to hedge against inflation, you got to do that. And by the way, you know, you could buy the physical gold, you know, but you know, these things are awfully risky. Stick to indexes.
Yeah. Well, and Exxon has actually doubled twice in the last 10 years. Thus, Lee Raymond walking off with $400 million. But that's a whole another story. Gary Weiss, the book Wall Street versus America: The Rampant Greed and Dishonesty That Imperil Your Investments. Gary, thanks for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
How does it feel to be one of the wealthiest people? Everyone knows who you are. You're on a winning streak. You're the computer software czar. The world's most successful geek.
Hey, welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Yes, welcome back. President Bush welcomed communist Chinese dictator Hu Jintao to the White House today for talks At least they say they're talking about human rights, Iran, and trade. What I thought was particularly interesting was in this public talk, you know, Bush comes out and he gives a speech, and then who gives a speech? And then who gets heckled, and the heckler gets dragged off. We'll get to that in just a second. But who, you know, first of all, Bush says, as the relationship between our two nations grows and matures, we can be candid about our disagreements. Yeah, right. Like, they're gonna really pay attention to you, George. He says, I'll continue to discuss with President Hu the importance of respecting human rights and the freedoms of the Chinese people. Mm-hmm. Now, China has a big army. You know, it's the world's largest. And they have nuclear weapons. And China was essentially, until all of our jobs went there, a third world nation, and many would argue still should be considered one. But China, who says to China, says to Bush in his talk that China really is the same as the U.S. He says, we're ready to embrace, to enhance dialogue and exchanges with the U.S. side on the basis of mutual respect and equality to promote the world's cause of human rights. This from the guy who supervises the murder of political prisoners so that their organs can be sold. No, I'm not kidding you. There is a trade in wealthy people going to China and saying, hey, I need a liver, I need a kidney, I need an eye transplant, whatever, you know, or cornea, whatever it may be, and here's my blood type. And all of a sudden, the next day, gee, just exactly the organ you need showed up. Where'd that come from? Well, we had a political protester. We took him out back and shot him. I believe it was 60 Minutes that outed this whole thing. Then Bush says, oh, we're going to work to stop the violence unleashed by terrorists and extremists. Mm-hmm. And President Hu is saying to himself, yeah, terrorists and extremists. Let's see. That would be Falun Gong you're talking about, right? And, in fact, this is what happened. The ceremony, as CNN reports, the ceremony was disrupted by a screaming protester who appeared on a platform used by news photographers and shouted first in English, President Bush, stop him from persecuting the Falun Gong, which is this kind of semi-meditation, quasi-religious, part-time, healthy living cult in China, which the government of China began cracking down on in 1999. Keep in mind, officially, religion is illegal in China. And then this woman shouted in Chinese, she said, President Hu, your days are numbered, according to a translation by reporters on the scene. And so the Secret Service hustles her off, and President Hu is saying to himself, yes, George W. Bush knows how to handle this kind of stuff. They do it the same way we do it. And he's probably turning to his wife and saying, find out her blood type. You need something new? How's your hip doing? Having a little problem there? I think we've got a donor. And at the same time, we are exporting all our jobs over there. The undeclared war on America's middle class, and I would say, frankly, it's a declared war, but the undeclared war on America's middle class started with Ronald Reagan in 1980, or in the election of 80, Reagan in 81, busting PATCO and saying, basically, we don't want to have unions in the United States. This is Reagan's shtick. We don't want to have unions in the United States. We don't want to have any kind of government protection for the people, particularly from corporate predators. That's, excessive lawsuits, right? We can't have that. And we can't have a working class that is also a middle class in the United States. We want to have a working class that's the working poor in the United States. Because you look at the 60s and the 70s, which preceded the election of 1980, And it was the time in the 200-year history of the United States at that time when the middle class was the strongest, was economically the strongest. It was the time when unions were the strongest. It was the time when taxes were the highest on the very wealthy. And as a result of the middle class being so strong, people were, and education being relatively inexpensive, social mobility was high, people were willing to speak out. They were willing to take to the streets. They were willing to protest. They were willing to defy authority. They were willing to defy convention. And the conservatives looked at this and said, this is not the way things should be. We need to get these people back into the working poor. And so export their jobs to China. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
19 miles to Baghdad. What have I become? New York got snow in April. And I can't locate the sun. A yellow ribbon around something.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, helping you win the water cooler wars in the real free speech zone. No barbed wire fences. No RNC passes required. No program where it's as easy to tune in as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Welcome back to the program. On this day in history, April 20th, 1818, James Monroe. President James Monroe, as I recall, the fifth president of the United States, very happily saw Congress pass his call to uphold the fiscal integrity, this in the History Channel, to use their phraseology, the fiscal integrity of domestic industry and give the green light to sharply protectionist tariff legislation. Not only did the tariff hike duties on iron imports, it also put the brakes on an anticipated decrease in the levy charged on textiles. So what happened? America became a steel and textile giant. Gee, what a surprise. In fact, the History Channel notes, in the years following the tariff of 1818, America's fondness for tariffs grew especially pronounced. By the 1820s, duties climbed to unprecedented levels. Well, there are limits, right? America's proclivity for protectionism faded by the early to mid-20th century when the Great Depression and World War II prompted U.S. leaders, including FDR, to shift to a more liberal fiscal course and open the doors to international trade. Well, I wouldn't say open the doors. I'd say crack the doors. Now the doors are open. Now they are flung wide open. By the way, those of you who are wondering, as predicted, it looks like Karl Rove is going down. Whenever somebody gets demoted out of the White House, you can usually bet that, you know, the next week there's going to be something coming down the line about them, whether it's shoplifting or an indictment for outing CIA agents or who knows. This Jason Leopold writing over at Truthout, this report, breaking news. He says, just as the news broke Wednesday about Scott McClellan resigning as White House Press Secretary and Deputy Chief of Staff, Karl Rove shed, just as the news was breaking about McClellan and Rove, Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald met with the grand jury hearing evidence in the CIA leak case and introduced additional evidence against Rove, according to attorneys and other officials close to the investigation. Grand jury session in federal court this yesterday in Washington, D.C., according to sources close to the case. This was the first time this year that Fitzgerald told the jurors that he would soon present them with a list of criminal charges he intends to file against Karl Rove in hopes of having the grand jury return a multi-count indictment against Rove. Now, just pause frame for a minute here. You know, Mr. Ryan, the governor of Illinois, was just nailed from serious crimes, and a whole bunch of people along with him. The former Republican governor of Illinois. You know who did that? Patrick Fitzgerald. And he started out with a low-level, essentially leak, a low-level story of some corruption that was going on way down low, like in the press office or something, something that didn't seem to have any connection at all to the governor. And he just got a hold of this thread, and he kept pulling on it and kept pulling on it and kept pulling on it, and pretty soon the whole thing unraveled, and there was the governor. Robert Luskin, Rove's attorney, in an interview yesterday, confirmed that Rove remains a subject of Fitzgerald's two-year probe. Subject means that they're seriously considering prosecution. Luskin said, Mr. Fitzgerald hasn't made any decision on the charges, and I won't speculate on what the outcome will be. Mr. Rove has completely cooperated with the investigation. But Jason Leopold reports, Fitzgerald is said to have introduced more evidence Wednesday alleging Rove lied to FBI investigators and the grand jury when he was questioned about how he found out that Valerie Plame Wilson worked for the CIA and whether he shared that information with the media, creating attorneys close to the case. See, what's happening here, this is the Martha Stewart problem. Martha Stewart, you know, was initially being investigated for insider stock trading. She lied to one of the guys talking to her. She could have just as easily said, I'm not going to talk to you. Or she could have told the truth, apparently. But because she lied to them, she spent 6 months in prison. As I recall, it was 6 months, something like that, thereabouts. So it's the cover-up is worse than the crime, right? In fact, Bob Novak is now out saying, you know, there's not a crime here. This is from the Chicago Sun-Times, the paper that syndicates Bob Novak, an article by Dave Neubart, staff reporter. Robert Novak said Wednesday that Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald knows who outed a CIA agent to the Chicago Sun-Times columnist, but hasn't acted on the information because Novak's source committed no crime. Now, let's see. Who could out a CIA agent and have it not be a crime? That would have to be somebody who has the statutory authority to out a CIA agent. In other words, to declassify things on the fly. Who would that be? Well, according to a presidential directive issued by George W. Bush, that's him and Dick Cheney. Novak also hinted that he personally didn't rely on the Fifth Amendment, which protects people from testifying against themselves in Fitzgerald's investigation. This back from Dave Neubart's piece in the Chicago Sun-Times. Fitzgerald is investigating who leaked CIA operative Valerie Plame's name to Novak and other reporters in an effort to discredit her husband, a critic of the Bush administration. Novak made his remarks at the first of an occasional series of forums jointly sponsored by the Sun-Times and the University of Illinois at Chicago. He was asked what he could say about it. He acknowledged the swirl of speculation. He called it ridiculous. He says, I'm not going to tell you because it's none of your damn business. But he did say, if I'd gone before a grand jury and taken the Fifth Amendment, Mr. Fitzgerald would have that on the street in about 2 minutes. In other words, you know, he told him. He also said, the question is, does Mr. Fitzgerald know who the source was? Of course he does. He's known for years who the first source is. If he knows the source, why don't they indict him? Because no crime was committed. Oh. Novak said he doesn't believe his source violated federal laws forbidding the disclosure of a CIA agent's identity. Isn't this interesting? So we have Bob Novak saying that whoever outed Valerie Plame didn't commit a crime. And then you have Karl Rove lying to cover up what? Could it be the involvement of his boss, George W. Bush? Fitzgerald, back to Jason Leopold's piece from Truth Out. Fitzgerald told the grand jury that Rove lied to investigators and the prosecutor 8 out of the 9 times he was questioned about the leak, and also tried to cover up his role in disseminating Valerie Plame Wilson's CIA status to at least 2 reporters. Additionally, an FBI investigator reread to jurors testimony from other witnesses in the case that purportedly implicates Rove in playing a role in the leak and the campaign to discredit Plame Wilson's husband, former Ambassador Joe Wilson. Luskin said Rove has not discussed any plea deal with Fitzgerald. Luskin is Rove's lawyer, keep in mind. He would not discuss the substance of his most recent communication with Fitzgerald, nor would he say whether Rove would testify against his former White House colleague, Scooter Libby. And he wouldn't comment on whether the investigation of Rove continues to center on alleged misleading statements, in other words, lies, to which Rove testified regarding a July 2003 conversation he had about Plame Wilson with Matt Cooper of Time magazine. Luskin said Rove simply forgot about his conversation with Cooper when he testified before the grand jury because he's been dealing with other pressing matters such as Bush's reelection campaign. Ah, now we get it. He's just too busy. But apparently he left a paper trail. On July 11th, 2003, he sent an email to Stephen Hadley, the guy who's now Bush's national security advisor. And in his first two appearances before the grand jury, Rove apparently didn't disclose the existence of this email. He said he learned about Plame Wilson from the news stories. But in the email he wrote to Hadley, he says, "I didn't take the bait. Matt Cooper called to give me a heads up that he's got a welfare reform story coming. When he finished his brief heads up, he immediately launched into Niger. Isn't this damaging? Hasn't the president been hurt? I didn't take the bait. But I said if I were him, I wouldn't get time far out in front on this." Oh-ho. So he doesn't remember it, but he wrote an email about it. Hadley is also a subject of the investigation. So we've got the guy who has the job that Condi Rice used to have being looked at. We have Karl Rove who's being looked at by the grand jury. And you wonder why he just was taken down a notch in his job. You wonder who's next. Might it be Scotty McClellan? Has he been called before the grand jury? Is he going to be called next? Are we going to end up, as of this moment, the administration with the most convicted felons in the history of the United States was the Reagan administration. Is the Bush administration soon to follow? Stay tuned. 46 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Didn't know I was in the minority. All people who love the earth. I hope it becomes a priority before it gets any worse. And what I believe in looks like heaven to me.
And welcome back. You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman, 9 minutes before the hour, and greetings to the folks from Yahoo Political Chat Room number 10 who are dropping into our live chat room, and welcome to the program in the chat room. You can get to our live chat room, by the way, by going to TomHartman.com and click the live chat link. It's very simple. If you have pop-up suppression enabled on your computer, you may have to hold down your control key when you hit the register button to first register for the chat room, because it does pop up a window for you to put in your name and you know, to create a password for yourself, and gets you in there. So anyhow, it is China alert time. Yes, we all need to be learning Chinese. Xi. No, that's Chinese, not English. Yeah. While who is meeting with Bush, the Shrub? No, Bush. And a woman from Falun Gong is telling Hu that his days are limited. A Chinese national, this is from Reuters, a Chinese national living in Southern California admitted trying to arrange the sale from China to the United States of 200 shoulder-fired missiles that can be used to bring down airplanes. Chao Tung Wu, 51, pleaded guilty in Los Angeles federal court to conspiring to import the missiles for a buyer who turned out to be an undercover FBI agent. When Wu was indicted in November, along with another man, Yi Qing Chen, they became the first people charged under a 2004 U.S. law forbidding the import of aircraft-destroying missile systems into the United States. Wu, who also admitted to trafficking methamphetamine, counterfeit bills, cigarettes, and ecstasy tablets into the United States, made a plea bargain agreement with U.S. prosecutors in hopes of reducing a possible 25-year prison term. The indictment identifies the missiles as the QW-2 shoulder-fired type used by the Chinese military since the late 1990s. According to court papers, the undercover FBI agent was told the missiles would be shipped from China to Cambodia and then to the United States with the help of bribed officials. The third-party country was later changed to Paraguay, but the missiles were never delivered. Wen is scheduled to be sentenced on July 31st. In the meantime, a couple of days ago, Bill Gates, in a luncheon talk with Chinese president and, or I'd say, communist Chinese dictator Hu Jintao, said, "This new era of an internet-based economy also presents new challenges to us all." Well said. I agree. He went on to say, "It is my belief that industry and government around the world should work even more closely to protect the privacy and security of Internet users and promote the exchange of ideas while respecting legitimate government considerations." I'll just let you figure out what that means. Because I frankly don't know. But I am concerned when anybody says that a communist dictatorship's rules about what can and can't go on the web are legitimate government considerations. Yes, but what can you say? There's money to be made. There's serious money to be made in the Chinese market because, after all, the cons want to make sure that there's no middle class in the United States any longer. We've got to export those jobs over to China, and those that we can't export to China, we have to replace with cheap labor from Mexico. I mean, it's just got to be done. You can't have a strong middle class and a vibrant democracy because then you're going to have dissent, and you can't have dissent if you're going to have a conservative oligarchy running the country or a theocracy. You can't have dissent if you're going to keep people convinced that, you're either with us or you're against us. You're either evil or you're good, right? You can't have it. It's not right. It doesn't work.
He's with us or against us. You're either evil or you're good.
Yeah, and then, of course, as we started 2 hours ago, the whole idea of it's all the gays' fault. Right?
And I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, "You helped this happen."
Well, I totally concur. And the problem is we have adopted that agenda at the highest levels of our government, and so we're responsible as a free society for what the top people do, and the top people, of course, the court system.
Yeah, so let's stack the courts. It gets weirder and weirder, doesn't it? Now, here, to the ultimate weirdness, let me just leave you at the end of this hour with this. The company, the biggest company that just got busted in this INS raid, IFCO Systems, IFCO Systems, they're importing illegal immigrants from Central and South America into the United States to work in offices from Bilgerville, Pennsylvania, to Charlotte, North Carolina, upstate New York, Cincinnati, Houston, Phoenix, Richmond, and Westboro, Mass. Apparently, this is where the raids took, according to ICE, U.S. immigration spokesman. It's owned by a German company. So we have a German company that bought the biggest pallet manufacturer in the United States, or built it, because we're so in debt to the rest of the world, we've got to have foreign companies come in and buy our companies. So everybody working there is, all the profits are going back to Germany. And the labor they're bringing in is coming from Mexico. And who's paying for their products? Well, you and me. This is the absolute death of the American middle class at the hands of conservative economic theoreticians. The Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, Free Traders, Thomas Friedman, Free Traders and Flat Earthers. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. It's the third hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. A jump in prices stirs rate concerns. This in the Wall Street Journal. Tell me if this makes sense. Inflation is running between 2 and 3%, according to the government. Now, the Consumer Price Index, things like Social Security are indexed to this, so it has to stay low, or the cost to government of things like Social Security grow rather rapidly. But if you look at the 12-month period that just ended in March of 2006, the price of energy has gone up 17.3%. The cost of transportation gone up over 5%. The cost of medical care gone up over 4%. The cost of housing, 3.7%. Only apparel has gone negative. It's dropped 1.2%. In other words, more cheap stuff coming in from China is apparently the only thing keeping down inflation. And yesterday, you know, there was this story that the Fed was saying, oh, you know, we're not going to raise interest rates after the next meeting. We will in the May meeting, but not in the June meeting. Or that was the interpretation everybody's putting on it, the stock market going through the roof. Now, a rise in consumer prices in March reignited concern that the Federal Reserve may have more work to do in its efforts to contain inflation. In other words, they may start raising interest rates again. Troubling to economists was a 0.3% jump in core prices, an index that excludes the volatile energy and food sectors. The report stoked worries that more interest rate increases may be needed to damp inflationary pressures. Now, at the same time that we're sitting around in the United States worrying about whether or not inflation is going to eat us alive, and that the only thing that's keeping it from doing so is that we have access to cheap labor and thus cheap products, you know, and as we keep traveling around the world finding cheaper and cheaper labor, China keeps finding more and more slaves essentially to work for us, we can hold down the price of things and thus not have inflation here at home. At the same time this is going on, and the middle class, of course, here in the United States being wiped out as a result of it, China is growing at a blistering 9.5% pace this year, India 7.3%, this according to the International Monetary Fund. Now, not only did they point out that, and that, for example, many sub-Saharan African nations projecting to grow 5.8% this year. Why? Because they're selling us oil. Not only that, the IMF also cautioned that failure to deal with massive trade imbalances increases the possibility that currencies will adjust. Now, I'm reading this in the Wall Street Journal, an article by Christopher Conkley and Michael Phillips. Okay, I'll just read it straight up here. The IMF cautioned that failure to deal with massive trade imbalances increases the possibility that currencies will adjust suddenly. Dash. The dollar might plunge, for instance, dash, causing an increase in interest rates and a slowdown in economic growth. IMF chief economist Raghuram Rajan advised the U.S. to cut the federal budget deficit more aggressively than the Bush administration has so far indicated it plans to try to do. Now, that's the budget deficit. That's the amount of money that we're spending, that the government spends beyond what it brings in taxes. The previous sentence was about the trade deficit, the amount that we buy from other countries versus what we sell to them. We have twin deficits. We used to have twin surpluses. or at various times we've had the deficits in one and surpluses in the other is actually probably a more accurate description. We've had a budget deficit of sorts pretty much for most of the history of this country. But it's been relatively small. The amount of debt that George W. Bush has run up is greater than that of all other presidents combined except Ronald Reagan. And when Reagan ran, did his Reaganomics, he did trickle-down economics, supply-side economics, he ran up a greater debt than every president before him. They go on to add, tighter fiscal policies, the IMF said, would also help narrow the U.S. trade gap by reducing American demand for imports. Well, if we stop demanding imports, we're going to start making stuff at home. The price of these things is going to go up. We're going to have inflation. It's like we have created this vice that we are in, the jaws of. And it's been created by these insane conservative economic policies, these economic policies that say what's good for multinational corporations is good for America. And, you know, sometimes that's the case, but sometimes it's not. Here's where it gets really bizarre. I mean, this is where you, I mean, out on the edge of things. This from the Press Trust of India. President George W. Bush has warned the country's school children. Now, this is the Indian press talking to people in India. President George W. Bush has warned America's school children that if they did not have the skills needed to compete with their counterparts from India and China, new jobs would go to those countries. Addressing a magnet school in Rockville, Maryland, George W. Bush said, quote, if you're living in Midland, Texas, or living in Montgomery County, Maryland, it's important to understand if children don't have those skill sets needed to compete with a child from India or a child from China, the new jobs will be going there, Bush told the students. And so, in order to make sure, Bush said, that we remain the leader of the world, we have got to continue our focus. We have got? It's redundant. But in any case, we have got to continue our focus in education on high standards, accountability, and a new focus, an intense focus on math and science, just like as what's happening in this school, he said. Quoting the Press Trust of India. Now, this was a major headline in India. Did you see any American newspaper pick this up? Any American media? That on April 18th, George W. Bush was down in Montgomery County, Maryland, and he gave a speech to a group of students, and he told them that if they didn't develop, if they didn't learn their lessons, their jobs were going to go to India or China. I mean, maybe it happened and I completely missed it, but I don't think so. I mean, it is just, boom, slid past the radar screen of this country. In the meantime, Senator Byron Dorgan has come out and said ExxonMobil's Lee Raymond's $400 million investment retirement package is a, quote, shameful display of greed, end quote. He's criticizing the head of ExxonMobil. Well, I would say respectfully to the senator and to all of us, really. I mean, you know, we need to look at this. You wouldn't have a $400 million retirement package if income taxes were the same as they were when Dwight Eisenhower was president. Let's pick a Republican president just to make it very palatable. Taxes that Dwight Eisenhower thought were a good idea. Where in today's dollars, you don't pay much tax at all on your first $20,000 or $30,000 in income, and you pay a little bit of tax on your next $40,000, $50,000, and you start paying some substantial taxes on the $60,000, $70,000, up to $100,000, maybe 30%, 40%, you get up around $100,000 a year. You get up to $1 million a year, you're paying about a 50% income tax, and then when you start pushing around $6 million a year in today's dollars, you hit the 90% bracket. And anything above your 6 millionth dollar, the government gets 90 cents of it, and you keep a dime.
The fact of the matter is that that's where our, that's how our tax, our income tax system was organized from the 1930s until Jack Kennedy became president, and he dropped that top rate down to 70%. And it stayed there until 1980. So during the time of the golden age of the American middle class, that's how our tax structure was organized. It didn't stop people from becoming millionaires or billionaires. It just slowed them down a little. But it also built a powerful middle class, a powerful nation. And it prevented these kinds of examples of conspicuous excess. Because, I mean, you know, why give somebody $400 million when they're going to, you know, walk away with $4 million of it or $40 million of it? Well, $40 million is not inconsequential, I suppose, but there has to be a better way, right? They figure out. So, I mean, let's just go back to the tax system that we used to have that worked so well for this country. Oh, that's right. The conservatives didn't like it. That's right. Ronald Reagan campaigned against it. I forgot. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. It's the third hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. A jump in prices stirs rate concerns. This in the Wall Street Journal. Tell me if this makes sense. Inflation is running between 2 and 3%, according to the government. Now, the Consumer Price Index, things like Social Security are indexed to this, so it has to stay low, or the cost to government of things like Social Security grow rather rapidly. But if you look at the 12-month period that just ended in March of 2006, the price of energy has gone up 17.3%. The cost of transportation gone up over 5%. The cost of medical care gone up over 4%. The cost of housing 3.7%. Only apparel has gone negative. It's dropped 1.2%. In other words, more cheap stuff coming in from China is apparently the only thing keeping down inflation. And yesterday, you know, there was this story that the Fed was saying, oh, you know, we're not going to raise interest rates after the next meeting. We will in the May meeting, but not in the June meeting. Or that was the interpretation everybody's putting on it, the stock market going through the roof. Now, a rise in consumer prices in March reignited concern that the Federal Reserve may have more work to do in its efforts to contain inflation. In other words, they may start raising interest rates again. Troubling to economists was a 0.3% jump in core prices, an index that excludes the volatile energy and food sectors. The report stoked worries that more interest rate increases may be needed to damp inflationary pressures. Now, at the same time that we're sitting around in the United States worrying about whether or not inflation is going to eat us alive, and that the only thing that's keeping it from doing so is that we have access to cheap labor and thus cheap products, you know, and as we keep traveling around the world finding cheaper and cheaper labor, China keeps finding more and more slaves essentially to work for us, we can hold down the price of things and thus not have inflation here at home. At the same time this is going on, and the middle class, of course, here in the United States being wiped out as a result of it, China is growing at a blistering 9.5% pace this year. India, 7.3%. This according to the International Monetary Fund. Now, not only did they point out that, and that, for example, many sub-Saharan African nations projecting to grow 5.8% this year. Why? Because they're selling us oil. Not only that, the IMF also cautioned that failure to deal with massive trade imbalances increases the possibility that currencies will adjust. Now, I'm reading this in the Wall Street Journal, an article by Christopher Conkley and Michael Phillips. Okay, I'll just read it straight up here. The IMF cautioned that failure to deal with massive trade imbalances increases the possibility that currencies will adjust suddenly.
dash. The dollar might plunge, for instance, dash, causing an increase in interest rates and a slowdown in economic growth. IMF chief economist Raghuram Rajan advised the U.S. to cut the federal budget deficit more aggressively than the Bush administration has so far indicated it plans to try to do. Now, that's the budget deficit. That's the amount of money that we're spending, that the government spends beyond what it brings in taxes. The previous sentence was about the trade deficit, the amount that we buy from other countries versus what we sell to them. We have twin deficits. We used to have twin surpluses. Or at various times we've had the deficits in one and surpluses in the other is actually probably a more accurate description. We've had a budget deficit of sorts pretty much for most of the history of this country. But it's been relatively small. The amount of debt that George W. Bush has run up is greater than that of all other presidents combined except Ronald Reagan. And when Reagan did his Reaganomics, he did trickle-down economics, supply-side economics, he ran up a greater debt than every president before him. They go on to add tighter fiscal policies, the IMF said, would also help narrow the U.S. trade gap by reducing American demand for imports. Well, if we stop demanding imports, we're going to start making stuff at home. The price of these things is going to go up. We're going to have inflation. It's like we have created this vice that we are in, the jaws of. And it's been created by these insane conservative economic policies. These economic policies that say what's good for multinational corporations is good for America. And, you know, sometimes that's the case, but sometimes it's not. Here's where it gets really bizarre. I mean, this is where you, I mean, out on the edge of things. This from the Press Trust of India. President George W. Bush has warned the country's school children. Now, this is the Indian press talking to people in India. President George W. Bush has warned America's school children that if they did not have the skills needed to compete with their counterparts from India and China, new jobs would go to those countries. Addressing a magnet school in Rockville, Maryland, George W. Bush said, quote, if you're living in Midland, Texas, you're living in Montgomery County, Maryland, it's important to understand if children don't have those skill sets needed to compete with a child from India or a child from China, the new jobs will be going there, Bush told the students. And so, in order to make sure, Bush said, that we remain the leader of the world, we have got to continue our focus. We have got. That's redundant. But in any case, we have got to continue our focus in education on high standards, accountability, and a new focus, an intense focus on math and science, just like as what's happening in this school, he said. Quoting the Press Trust of India. Now, this was a major headline in India. Did you see any American newspaper pick this up? Any American media? That on April 18th, George W. Bush was down in Montgomery County, Maryland, and he gave a speech to a group of students, and he told them that if they didn't develop, if they didn't learn their lessons, their jobs were going to go to India or China. I mean, maybe it happened and I completely missed it, but I don't think so. I mean, it is just, boom, slid past the radar screen of this country. In the meantime, Senator Byron Dorgan has come out and said ExxonMobil's Lee Raymond's $400 million investment retirement package is a, quote, shameful display of greed, end quote. He's criticizing the head of ExxonMobil. Well, I would say respectfully to the senator and to all of us, really, I mean, you know, we need to look at this. You wouldn't have a $400 million retirement package if income taxes were the same as they were when Dwight Eisenhower was president. Let's pick a Republican president just to make it very palatable.
taxes that Dwight Eisenhower thought were a good idea. Where in today's dollars, you don't pay much tax at all on your first $20,000 or $30,000 in income, and you pay a little bit of tax on your next $40,000, $50,000, and you need to start paying some substantial taxes on the $60,000, $70,000 up to $100,000, maybe 30%, 40%, you get up around $100,000 a year. You get up to $1 million a year, you're paying about a 50% income tax. And then when you start pushing around $6 million a year in today's dollars, you hit the 90% bracket. And anything above your 6 millionth dollar, the government gets 90 cents of it and you keep a dime. The fact of the matter is that that's how our income tax system was organized from the 1930s until Jack Kennedy became president, and he dropped that top rate down to 70%, and it stayed there until 1980. So during the time of the golden age of the American middle class, that's how our tax structure was organized. It didn't stop people from becoming millionaires or billionaires. It just slowed them down a little. But it also built a powerful middle class, a powerful nation, and it prevented these kinds of examples of conspicuous excess. Because, I mean, you know, why give somebody $400 million when they're going to, you know, walk away with $4 million of it or $40 million of it? Well, $40 million is not inconsequential, I suppose, but there has to be a better way, right? They figure out. So, I mean, let's just go back to the tax system that we used to have that worked so well for this country. Oh, that's right. The conservatives didn't like it. That's right. Ronald Reagan campaigned against it. I forgot. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Didn't know I hated my country for acknowledging the truth. This was despicable profiteering at the expense of our youth. And what I believe in looks like heaven to me.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 25 minutes before the hour, or will be in about 15 seconds. Welcome back to our program. The students, SEIU Local 11, this is the University of Miami. Justice for Miami condominium workers. The University of Miami, the strike is ongoing. We're day 16 of this, I believe. Looking at the SEIU 11.org is their website. And there's a hunger strike going on there. University of Miami students take over a central campus building to protest civil rights abuses. Why is this not being reported by the mainstream media? Why is this not a huge story? Actually, I'll tell you why in just a second. On the heels of an appeal, this is from the SEIU11.org's website, on the heels of an appeal by local clergy members in the University of Miami faculty that janitors on the 15th day of a hunger strike step down and permit the community to take up the fast in their name, university students overwhelmed the school's admissions office in a show of concern and support. Janitors who refused to end their fast, more than 75 workers and supporters rallied outside the building in support of janitors employed by Unico, UNICCO services, and their fight for a better life. Charles Steele Jr., president and CEO of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And again, why haven't we heard his name more often in the mainstream media? Same reason. We'll get to that in a moment. National civil rights leader. He's down there speaking out in support of the Miami janitors campaign for justice today. This was yesterday, actually. Steele called on the university president, Donna Shalala. Gee, where did we hear her name? That's right. It was yesterday or the day before when we were looking into the board of directors of this corporation that just paid its CEO $1.6 billion. Remember that? The second largest healthcare company in the United States? Yeah. So anyhow, University of Miami president, Donna Shalala, Steele called on her to stop shielding the company she hired to clean the schools, Unicosis to Services of Boston, whose multi-state record of violating workers' civil rights has drawn criticism from civil rights activists all around the country. Day 14, this was 2 days ago,
Today at 8:30 a.m., Pablo Rodriguez, 31, awoke feeling weak. He then began to shake. His blood pressure dropped to dangerous levels. An ambulance was called. He was taken to doctor's hospital. Fatigue and weakness has increased to dangerous levels over the past few days for all the remaining men and women on the hunger strike. I'm concerned, writes the correspondent, posting on the homepage of SEIU11.org. I'm concerned that we will see metabolic deterioration that can cause serious complications in the remaining janitors on the fast. If you want more information about this, call Donna Shalala. You can just call her office, right? The University of Miami, the president, Donna Shalala, 305-284-5155. You can tell her, hey, Donna, you've got the power to resolve this strike. I mean, this is SEIU points this out on their website, SEIU11.org. You have the power to resolve this strike. You should intervene on behalf of the workers. And you should make Unico to allow the workers to form a union using the most fair and democratic means available, which is a card check election process where all parties remain neutral. So you can give Donna Shalala a call. If you want the phone number, it's over there at SEIU11.org, or I'll give it to you again. It's 305, area code 305, down there in Miami, 305-284-5155. 305-284-5155. Donna Shalala, please respect these working people. Now, back to the original question. Here we have a major university in the United States. Janitors on a fast, on a hunger strike, going into its 16th day. I guess now you'd say it's going into its 17th day. People starving themselves. Over what? Just decent wages, basic worker rights stuff. You can download podcasts, by the way, from the hunger strike at SEIU11.org as well. And why are we not hearing about this in the mainstream media? Because the mainstream media is owned by the same corporations on whose boards people like Donna Shalala serve. I'm old enough to remember a time when I was a kid. I'm an old man here. I remember the old days when... No, I'm serious here. I remember the 1950s, the late 1950s and the early 1960s. Well, not even the early, throughout the 60s, even into the early 70s, as I recall, when I was growing up in Michigan, when every town had its own local newspaper, sometimes two, sometimes three. Detroit had a couple of statewide papers, the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press. One was the labor paper, and they had a section in there called Labor. And every day they reported on the labor happenings all over the state of Michigan and all over the country. And so you always knew what was going on in labor. And if there was a labor story, like janitors on strike, they're starving themselves to death, 15 days going on this thing, at the University of Miami, it would have been the front page. And the other paper was the Republican corporate paper. And they didn't have a labor section. They just had a business section. Two competing papers. The labor paper, which represented probably 90% of the people in the state, people who worked for a living, and the business paper, which represented maybe 5-10% of the people in the state, people who were retired, people who were investing, people who owned their own businesses, people who worked in management. But, you know, they had a little more money. And every city in the United States was like that. I mean, go all the way back to the 1700s. You know, Thomas Jefferson, and the whole reason in 1798 why John Adams passed the Alien and Sedition Acts, you know, jammed them through Congress, was so that he could put into jail over 20 newspaper publishers who were on the other side, who were on Jefferson's side, the Democratic Republican newspaper publishers, what's now called the Democratic Party. And he did. He put them in jail for speaking up. Ben Franklin's grandson, Benjamin Franklin Bach, thrown into jail by President John Adams because he called John Adams old, toothless, querulous, balding, and balding. Yeah, that's a prisonable offense. Well, it was in John Adams' mind. And we're back there again. And I'm telling you, the stories like this are not getting play, and they're not getting play because the corporations that basically own the media in this country don't want their employees unionized either. So check out SEIU11.org. See what they're up to there. Bob in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was thinking about something hit me in the head yesterday. But I think the oil companies have figured out the way to collect the tariff on jobs being outsourced. Because, you know, you look at it, the Americans, their consumption for oil hasn't gone down. They're chasing down cheaper paying jobs. But the demand on the oil has gone from the nations that are growing, like India and China. Right. So, I mean, when you want to frame something, I guess now, you know, we're finally paying the price at the oil pump because of what's been outsourced.
Yeah, and you know the big mistake that we made, both at the federal level and, as far as I know, every state government in the United States, there may be one or two that are the exceptions to this rule, but I believe that all the states have made the same mistake. And that is in setting gasoline taxes at a fixed amount. In other words, a gasoline tax is like 30 cents a gallon, period, no matter what. And instead, it should have been 10% of whatever the retail price is. So when the retail price goes up, the tax goes up. And that'll act as an automatic brake on the increase in the retail price. Because as the retail price goes up, you know, the oil companies are making more money. This is how Lee Raymond was able to, you know, walk off with $400 million from ExxonMobil. They're making more money, but the added tax, because the tax is a percentage rather than a fixed rate, is going to drive it up a little bit faster. And so the oil companies are going to have to back off a little bit.
Right.
And if all of the states, you know, were tomorrow to just wake up and slap their foreheads and go, whoa, we gotta get this right, and just take their existing tax right now, whatever their tax works out to. I mean, it was probably, say, 10% 5 years ago when gas was a buck a gallon when George W. Bush first came into office, and now at $3 a gallon, instead of being 10%, it's 3%. So let's just say, okay, 3%. From now on, it's always going to be 3% because this thing is going to go nowhere but up. And,
exactly.
And just change it to a percentage, that would slow down the rise in the price of gas, number one. And number two, it would increase the revenues to the states and to the federal government whenever ExxonMobil makes money, which seems like a reasonable thing.
Well, sure. But, I mean, again, we're paying for it because of the demand outside the U.S. has gone way, way up due to our own undoing.
Could be. I mean, if you look at what the oil companies are doing, is they are saying that their increase in the price of gasoline is justified because they're making it a percentage of the cost of oil. But it isn't a percentage of the cost of oil. In other words, if it costs, you know, let's say just arbitrarily, because I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. Let's say out of a barrel of oil, let's say to produce, you know, the 10, 15 gallons of gasoline that barrel of oil contains, that it costs them $10 to refine that, okay? Let's say you produce 10 cents a gallon. So now the price of and the price of oil is at $30 a barrel. So, you know, they're making a $20 profit. Now the price of oil goes up to $70 a barrel. You know, the cost to refine it is still $10 a barrel. The raw material cost has gone up slightly, but it hasn't, you know, gone up. I'm explaining this very poorly. I'll try again when we come back from the break. I'm mangling it. Bob, thanks for the call. Anyhow, I'll do it again. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
How pitiful, polluted skies are plagued with acid rain. Our purple mountains tragically are going down the drain. Now, wait a minute. I said, America, oh, America, we shed our waste only, and trash the woods with paper goods from sea to slimy sea.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour. Okay, here's how you say it. Gasoline's selling for $1 a gallon. 10 cents of that cost is the pass-through of the cost of oil. Okay, then you got the cost of distribution, you got the cost of refining, you got the profit for the oil company, you got all that stuff. And oil at $30 a barrel. When oil goes to $60 a barrel, that 10 cents becomes, say, the cost of the raw material doubled, that 10 cents becomes 20 cents. So the cost of a gallon of gas was a dollar, 10 cents of it was raw materials. Now it's 20 cents for raw materials. It should be $1.10, right? But what the oil companies do is they say, no. Because the cost of the raw material doubled, we're going to double the cost of the cost of gasoline. So it becomes $2. And what does that mean? It means that they make enormous profits. And that's why I'm saying the states, the federal government, they should be playing the same game with the taxes that the oil companies are playing with producer prices. Because this is why ExxonMobil, for example, over the last 10 years, the value of their stock has doubled twice. In other words, if you put $100,000 in ExxonMobil stock 10 years ago, it would have become worth $200,000, then it would have become worth $400,000. Nice work if you can get it, right? And then if you cashed it in, you pay capital gains tax on that, 15% maximum income tax, because the last Bush tax cut said if you're in the investor class and you make your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, you only pay a maximum 15% income tax. You don't pay any Social Security. Not too shabby. Thus, Lee Raymond walks off with $400 million because he ran this scam on us. Bill in Sacramento, California. Hey, Bill, do I have this right?
Yes and no. The best way to look at this is when it was $30 a barrel, and you have to understand the distillation process, they add things. There's a whole lot of stuff that's added. They get way more than 10 gallons out of a barrel.
Okay, yeah.
When we were charging when it was charged $30 a barrel, we were selling it for 30 cents at the pump, and that's like 1% in terms of, and they were still making a profit.
So the raw material cost wasn't 10%, it was 1%?
Oh, it was like, that was the price at the pump, 30 cents.
Right.
And that's only 1% of a $30 charge for the barrel.
Right.
So you can see that their distillation process yields a lot more. The cost of goods sold is really low. The oil companies were still making a profit even at 30 cents at the pump,
right,
including 18 cents for tax for a lot of states.
Right.
So now their increases have gone up over 70% even at the $70 price per barrel.
Right.
The reason.
Yeah, that's obvious
high,
from looking at their stock.
Yeah.
They're paying dividends like crazy. They're spilling profit over into the.
Right. The reason it's high is because they're holding back on the distribution from the distilleries. They're not keeping those online.
There's also essentially a monopoly in this. I mean, you've got a half a dozen companies that basically control
right.
the gasoline market in this country.
Right. I mean, they saw an opportunity with the emerging markets that are growing, like China, the other person was talking about. And the fact that they're holding back on the refineries. They're not refining the oil into gasoline.
Right. They're doing the same thing Enron did to California with regard to electricity.
Exactly. And so that's jacking the price up. They're training us to pay more, and they're robbing us real quick before we wake up. And the pressure from the global warming and all the other things culminates in us using other types of fuel.
Yeah. You work in the business, Bill?
No, not in the oil industry, but I've been in manufacturing for a long time.
But you understand it. Okay.
Yeah.
Bill, thanks a lot for enlightening us.
Sure.
And me too.
Oh, by the way, this whole thing, a lot of people don't remember, but there was a rush to get into Iraq. The reason they were rushing was Iraq was trying to come back online and produce oil, not for food, but for profit. They wanted to rebuild their country after all the wars and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they had tried to get the sanctions lifted. And we didn't want that to happen because if they started pumping oil, that was going to change the balance. Plus, Saudi Arabia had already told us that they couldn't continue to pump 12, 13 million barrels a day.
Right.
Because
the Saudi fields are in 8% annual decline right now.
Right. So we had to go in March before the United Nations would have released the information that they didn't have any weapons of mass destruction. That was the whole point, was to get in there right then, realign the Middle East, solve the Israel problem, as well as position themselves to right there at the gate of Asia and Africa, which is where those 12, 14 bases that they've built there and this huge embassy, they're there to stay.
Yeah, well, and in fact, the neocons are pretty explicit about this. Back in 1998, the Project for New American Century,
exactly.
Just laid it right out, said we need to have this heavy footprint in the Middle East. And by the way, it's going to take a Pearl Harbor-like event to make the American people go along with this.
Absolutely.
And George W. Bush, in his personal diary on September 11, 2001, wrote, "Today a Pearl Harbor event happened."
You remember
I
that,
kid
huh?
you not.
You remember that? I know. I'm well aware. Yeah. Iraq was also threatening to change over to the euro, and that would have destroyed the World Bank, which is a gold.
I'm familiar with that. Yeah. And Iran is now threatening the same thing. Bill, I gotta run, but I appreciate the call. It's great to hear from you, and thank you for listening there in KSAC in Sacramento. Coming up tomorrow, Congressman Bernie Sanders will be with us. Roland Menarin is going to be talking about how the Federal Reserve System rips us off. Jeffrey Kleinman, that and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Speak up. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.